So it's a very good question. So on Friday, you will have a bonus lecture about black hole thermodynamics. So if you are interested in that, you can come. If you are not interested, you can stay home and study for your interview or whatever. So this will be on Friday. So on Friday, I will have both lecture and the tutorial devoted to black hole thermodynamics, which is sort of related to what we do, but not really. All right, good morning. So let me start. So yesterday, we left the Ising universality class, and we considered a model which doesn't have the properties which are characteristic for the Ising universality class. So the Ising universality class is characterized by one scalar or a parameter and by a discrete Z2 symmetry of the Hamiltonian. So now we looked at what happens if you actually, instead of a discrete symmetry, you have a continuous symmetry, and if instead of one scalar or a parameter, you have actually n of those. And so a prototype model for this is this model called n vector model. This can still live in d dimensions. So d is the number of space dimension of spatial dimensions of your lattice. And so at each lattice point, you can have now a spin which doesn't have to point up or down, but rather is described by an n vector at each point here. And so then the corresponding Hamiltonian is simply given by minus 1 half sum over all possible interactions, jij, given by these interacting constants, jij. And then you have a scalar product of the two vectors, Si and Sj. And so you can check that this Hamiltonian has On continuous symmetry, meaning that if I rotate all the spins about some angle, actually the Hamiltonian takes the same value. But of course, I have to do it globally with all the spins. Okay. So now, respecting the symmetry and respecting the fact that I have n order parameters, you can immediately write down the corresponding Landau-Ginzburg functional, which we did in terms of phis. And I'm not going to repeat that here. But what is actually advantageous is that you say, well, I decompose this this vector phi into the magnitude and the unit vector. So n squared equals to 1. And this is the magnitude. Of course, all these things can depend on x in the continuous limit. And then we derived yesterday that the function looks like here, where you have the gradient for rho, then you have the gradient for the unit vector, and then you have the standard term as you know it from the Ising model. So you have rho square and rho to the 4. So now, when we studied the mean field theory approximation, we realized that in that case, these paths, there's no fluctuations. So this guy is actually 0. And so this is our Landau's functional. And by minimizing it, we realized that actually rho takes some average value, which we called rho 0. But n is arbitrary. So that means actually that I can be anywhere. So this is a picture for phi 1 and phi 2. But I can be anywhere on the circle with the radius rho 0. So of course, by choosing a concrete n, you are spontaneously breaking this On symmetry. Okay, so you are spontaneously breaking that. And so what we realize later on is that when we study some fluctuations around this mean field theory solution, we can consider two types of modes. So one type of modes, which is this delta phi 1, which actually is climbing up and down the potential, it behaves exactly as it would in the Ising model. And so that's so these types of modes are not really interesting. They are really described by the mean field theory. But however, you have also the second type of modes, which is the perpendicular, which is exactly in the direction of the minima of your Mexican hat potential. And so these modes are interesting. They are called, well, they are special case of Goldstone modes. And so they are massless modes. And they basically don't cost any energy if their momentum goes to 0. So if k goes to 0, then to create these massless modes doesn't cost any energy. And so what we have seen is that as you lower the number of dimensions, the spatial dimensions, actually these modes fluctuate more and more, and so they really fluctuate like crazy when you go to d equal to 2. And so basically, because of these huge fluctuations, they do not allow any order to be created. Okay, so they fluctuate like crazy, and so this d equal to 2 is called lower critical dimension. And so we motivated this famous theorem. So Coleman, Merman, and Wagner theorem. Theorem says that for systems with continuous symmetry, which is of course the case of our model, there is no long range order for d small or equal than 2. Okay, and so it's because these constant modes actually are really important, and whenever you know the spins would like to order, actually these modes, they can reach everywhere and they destroy this order. Okay, so this is interesting. So now what we'll see, and so why? So this was a theorem, and so it seems that this theorem actually implies that you cannot have really an ordered phase, and if you cannot have an ordered phase, it will suggest that you cannot have a phase transition from a disordered phase to the ordered one, right? So it seems like if you have systems with continuous symmetry, you don't get any phase transitions if you are in d small or equal than 2. So now the aim of this lecture is to show you that actually this is not true, and we sort of want to evade this theorem. And show you that there is actually certain type of phase transitions, nevertheless, in d equal to 2 dimensions. So aim today is to evade this theorem and show that actually we can have. A phase transition in d equal to 2 dimensions. Okay. However, of course, the problem is that with the theorems is that the theorems actually are true. So it's very difficult to evade them. So we will have to break some of the assumptions of the theorem. And in particular, I will show you that actually we can have some kind of phase transition, which, however, has basically nothing to do with long branch order. Okay, so we will have a phase transition without an order. And so that's the aim. So now let us concentrate on d equal to 2 dimensions, so near d equal to 2. Okay, so we have these Goldstone modes, and they fluctuate like crazy. And they, of course, what they do is that they kick your vector n so that it can sort of rotate around the radius rho zero. On the other hand, it's very, very difficult to change this rho zero because you would have to climb up and down the potential. So near d equal to 2, really what's happening is that the fluctuations of n are important, but the fluctuations of rho are not, because these do not cost anything, but these are costly. Okay, so near d equal to 2, fluctuations of rho around rho 0 are not important, really, about fluctuations of Na are. Okay, so if this is true, then actually, you can really set rho equal to rho 0. So we'll be setting rho equal to rho 0 and you will just forget about that that the system can have these delta phi 1 fluctuations. And we can only concentrate on this end part. So now, if you look at this Landau-Ginzburg functional, then, well, the last two terms, they just give you that rho is equal to rho 0 in the mean field theory approximation. So we actually kill them by saying, yeah, it's rho is equal to rho 0. Then the first term is nabla rho, which we are setting rho is equal to rho 0. So it's also gone. So the only thing which is actually left is that your Landau-Ginzburg function is now a function of n. And it's simply given by rho square over 2 ddx nabla na nabla na. So this is our effective Landau-Ginzburg functional. So now remember when we were deriving this continuous limit, well, we are doing lots of bad things. And so in the end, the coupling constants included some, you know, the lattice spacing, and they included the temperature and stuff like that. So actually, you can play with the units. And so you can write this that instead of rho square, which is this whatever rho zero is, you can actually put 1 over t here. So by changing the units, you can always achieve that this is true. Nabla na, nabla na. And so we will take this functional to be the important functional for the study around two dimensions. So this is by changing units. Change units. And so T is really the temperature here. OK, so now this looks very simple. So it seems that we have now something like a Gaussian theory. Right, so if you study the free scale field, you would just have nabla phi, nabla phi, and if you have many of them, you would have nabla phi a, nabla phi a. So this looks like a free theory. However, it's not completely a free theory because there's a constraint, and the constraint is that n a square is equal to 1, that n is a unit vector. So looks like a free theory but it is not because there is a constraint. Okay, and so this constraint actually is sort of making things more difficult, actually quite difficult. And so this model with this constraint is something which you will see basically in the string theory and something which you'll see later on in string theory explorations. And it's called nonlinear sigma model. So this functional is called nonlinear sigma model. Okay. Very good. Okay, so now we have the functional, and you would like to study this functional by doing the renormalization as we did for the Ising model. Of course, now we want to be near d equal to 2 dimensions, and so it would be rather stupid to do the expansion around d equal to 4 as we did around the mean field theory. So instead, you do actually the expansion around d equal to 2. So now set up a new expansion, set up a d equal to 2 plus epsilon expansion. So we are expanding it around d equal to 2 dimensions rather than around d equal to 4 dimensions. And so we know that from this CMW theorem, we know that actually if you are in 2 dimensions, the critical temperature has to be equal to 0. Okay, so you know that basically limit d is to 2 plus of t critical of d equals to 0 from the CMW theorem. Okay, so actually people are clever enough to use this fact, so they know that exactly if you are exactly at d equal to 2, you have to have the critical, the only critical temperature is at temperature equal to 0, and then you do like small perturbation around this. And it sort of works well. It doesn't work as good as the expansion around d equal to 4 dimensions, but still works nicely. And so you do the RG analysis of this functional, and you take this into account, and then you actually end up with the following RG equations for your coupling constant t. Well, I'll rescale that t here, and it's given by minus epsilon t plus n minus 2 kd, and then t tilde square. There's a tilde here, there's a tilde here. So this is the RG equation which you get. So epsilon is this d minus 2 here. Now you have explicit dependence on the number of fields here. And then this t tilde is just rescaled t. So it's t to cutoff times epsilon, cutoff to the power of epsilon. So it basically becomes t in two dimensions. And as always, this case KD is somehow related to the area of the d-dimensional sphere, 2 pi to power d, and now there is no cutoff dependence here. Okay, so this would be the RG equation which you are getting in this 2 plus epsilon expansion. Okay, so now if you look at these RG equations, you see that there is obviously solution t tilde equals to 0. So t tilde equal to 0 will be one fixed point. But because this is a quadratic equation, there is another fixed point there. And this the other fixed point will be of the order where t tilde is something like epsilon. Okay. So now if you actually plot the phase space diagram, the diagram for the flow, then at, so this is my t. And so this is 0. And so we have one fixed point at 0. And then we have another fixed point of the order of epsilon. So actually, if you solve it, you find that this is at the order epsilon over kd n minus 2. Okay, and so now you can study the stability of these things. And you will find that this critical point is unstable, whereas this one is stable. Okay. So you have a flow like that in that one-dimensional picture here. And so you will have actually a ferromagnetic phase here and a paramagnetic phase here. Okay, so around d equal to 2 dimensions, you have this nice flow here, and then you go to the right of this small temperature. So yeah, so here actually, if you are still above and d equal to 2 dimensions, you still have the ordered phase, which is given by this thing here. And you still have a critical temperature, which is precisely given by this expression here. Okay, so this is above 2 dimensions. But you see, because this is proportional to epsilon, then as you go to the d equal to 2 dimensions, of course, this guy travels here. And then you only recover the only critical point at t equal to 0 if you are in d equal to 2 dimensions. So certainly, this is not in contradiction with CMW theorem. OK, so this expansion is fine. And really, you can analyze it, what's happening close to 2 dimensions. So very good. So now, note that if you are exactly at d equal to 2 exactly, and this diagram is simply just this thing here. So the only critical point is here, and then it's flowing here. So you don't get an ordered phase for any finite temperature. In fact, at T equal to zero, there is an ordered phase. So here you would have something like a ferromagnet, but only exactly at T equal to zero. So by the way, if you write down this RG equation here, and I just plug T equal to two, then this term disappears. Okay, so this guy is dt tilde over dl is equal to n minus 2, n minus 2 kd, and t tilde square. Okay, so this is your RG equation exactly at d equal to 2. And what is quite interesting is that this thing here actually is precisely the beta function for Young-Del's theory in d equal to 4 dimensions. So this is actually a beta function for young males in d equal to 4. And so this already hints on something which people like when they study ADS CFT thing and integrability and stuff like that. So you will study that in your exploration string theory exploration course. And so where you will land that, you know, whatever happens in ADS is sort of dual to whatever happens in, so in 5 dimensions. So, so there's this amazing duality, which may be even true. So ADS 5 maps to CFT in d equal to 4. And that maps to spin chains in d equal to 2. Okay, so it seems that all these models actually are dual, and whatever is happening in spin chains in d equal to 2 dimensions should map directly to conformal field theory in 4 dimensions and should map to bulk spacetimes in 5 dimensions. Okay, so this you will discuss in your more advanced courses. At this point, I'm just noting that really the beta function is the same. Okay, so that's what I just want you to note at this point here. Okay, ask Pedro about this. So he is the expert. Very good. So now we have studied what happens near d equal to 2 and what happens near at exactly d equal to 2. But of course, even more interesting thing happens when d equals to 2, but n also equals to 2. Okay, so very special case. Very special case is when d equals to 2 equals to n. And so what happens then is that you're finding that dt over dl equals to 0, so beta function vanishes. Of course, this was, so I wrote this thing down only to the order of epsilon. Well, I have the leading term and then the next leading term. But actually, this will be true to any order in perturbation theory. I can show that. So to any order in perturbation theory. And so this is actually very suspicious, right? So it seems sort of that, yeah, you know, well, beta function vanishes for any t, right? So it seems that for any t, you have a fixed point. And so for any t, you have like a critical point. So, you know, the question mark, do we have a line of phase transitions, or line of critical points for every temperature. Okay, so that's actually an interesting case. So let us look at this case a little bit more. And let's look at what's happening with our nonlinear sigma model if you are exactly in d equal to 2 dimensions and if you have exactly 2 fields. Okay, so then n is equal to 2. Oh, we have too many n's. So n Okay, I'll have one more and okay, it doesn't matter. So writing. So since n is equal to 2, we can write the vector as simply in polar coordinates, cosine theta times x and sine theta times y. So cosine theta times the x unit vector plus sine theta times the y unit vector here. And of course, theta is just the polar angle here. So now what you have to do is that in order to write down what this functional is, you need to calculate what nabla on A is. Okay. Nabla on A. Well, I have to differentiate the cosine. I get minus sine. Minus sine theta and then nabla on theta and x. And then plus cosine theta nabla on theta times y. Okay, and then eventually what we want is nabla and a, nabla and a. So we have to square this. Okay. So nabla n times nabla n. Of course, x and y are perpendicular. So it's very simple. It's just this guy square plus that guy square. So it's sine square theta nabla theta square plus cosine square theta nabla theta square. Of course, sine square plus cosine square is 1, so it's 1 times nabla theta square. Okay, and so our functional is now very, very simple. So we have now s of theta is just 1 over 2t, and then d square x nabla theta square. Okay, so that's our Landau-Ginzburg functional describing our theory for n equal to 2 and in 2 dimensions. Okay, so again, this looks extremely simple. It again looks like nabla phi square free theory. But can you see why this is not exactly free theory? So what is the problem? Huh? Exactly. So why this is not really a free theory is that theta is an angle. So it's actually compactified on 0 to 2 pi. So theta runs from 0 to 2 pi. It's compactified. And so that's why this is not, again, a free theory. So this is a compact. And so not a free theory again. Okay, so now people know a lot of things about this theory. Actually, they know everything about this theory. Like you have three bosons on a sphere, like on a compact thing. So actually people know everything about that. But let's pretend we don't know. Okay. So let's pretend that we actually treat this as a free theory. And then, you know, impose, you know, see, you know, why this is actually important. Okay. So one thing you could calculate, so let's pretend. That theta is not compact. Is not compactified. So if you pretend that theta is not compactified, one thing you could actually calculate is the correlation function of n at x and n at 0. Okay, so you may want to calculate a correlation function. Okay, so you want to calculate really the correlation function of these n's, or these n's here, but we parameterize n as cosine theta plus sine theta. Okay, so this n is actually something like an exponential of I theta. Okay. So that's why I define the correlation function for n as e to I theta x and e to minus I theta at 0. Okay, so this is how I define that, because in the end, I want a correlation function for n. right? Okay, so now you can calculate this guy, pretending that theta is actually not, it doesn't go from 0 to pi, but it goes from 0 to infinity. Okay, so now this is some calculation to be done. I don't want to repeat it here, because we will spend the rest of the lecture today to actually find what this is equal to. And it's not very interesting. Well, there's some integrals, Gaussian integrals you have to do and stuff like that. Also, of course, the result diverges. So what you have to do is that you have to introduce a small cutoff. And so basically, you cannot integrate at the distances which are smaller than the lattice spacing. So in the end, I will have lattice spacing A entering the result. Okay, so I'm cutting everything which is smaller than lattice spacing. And so the result can actually be written as A over X to a power T over 2 pi. Okay, so have to believe me. If you don't believe me, do it yourself. It's actually not that difficult, but it's not that eliminating neither. Okay, so now we have this result for the correlation function when we are pretending that theta actually ran from 0 to infinity. Okay, so now what you want to do is that you want to compare this. So compare to what you would expect for the correlation function, which you know that the correlation function, if you are in d dimensions, should go something like e to minus x over xi times x d minus 2 plus eta. Okay, so this is what you would expect for the correlation function to behave like. And so you notice that we are definitely missing the exponential part. And we are in d equal to 2 dimensions, so we are getting x to some power eta. Okay, so by comparing these two things, we would conclude. So this is all very naive, but anyway, so we would conclude that because there is no exponential part, then the correlation like xi has to go to infinity. Okay. So in other words, there is no mass for these things. So we would conclude that xi goes to infinity because there is no exponential part. We are in d equal to 2 dimensions. That's why this x d minus 2 doesn't contribute. But we'd also conclude that eta is actually given by t over t 2 pi. So it seems, again, we have. So remember, we have fixed points for every t, right? Indeed, for every t, we seem to have that the correlation length diverges. So it seems like there's really a critical point for every t. And then we have some critical exponents, which actually depend on this t. Okay, so the corresponding critical exponents will depend on t. So we have like line of critical points with t-dependent critical exponents. Okay, so this is what we are getting. Well, that's pain, but anyway. So now what you also notice is that if you did the calculation and you got that result that g is actually proportional to 1 over x, so we know that g, if x goes to infinity, actually goes to 0. Okay, so that's another result which we learned from that correlation function here. But it's actually, so, okay, the correlation length goes to 0, but that means that we actually don't have an order. Okay, so there is no. So if you look at how I define this g of x, I define n of x and n at 0. But typically, as we would actually define the correlation function previously, is that we would subtract the average of n of x and average of n of 0. Okay. So now, if we have order, each of these goes to some average magnetization m. Right? So typically, if I included the terms minus average of the first one, average of the second one, I would be subtracting m squared. So if we had an order, this guy actually has to go to m squared. But it does not. So this is not equal to m squared. Right? So there is no long branch order. There is no long branch order. Because if there were, this guy would have to go to m squared. But it doesn't. It goes to 0. Okay. So far, so good. So this is certainly agrees with the theorem which we have. But we don't have a long branch order. Okay. So all these results are provided that theta is not compact. However, they are wrong. Okay, so this is wrong. This is at least physically wrong. And so the simplest way why this is actually wrong is that, well, it's certainly this thing here which we are finding. We are finding that for any temperature, the correlation length goes to infinity. Right? So we cannot have xi going to infinity for any t. So after all, you know, so all this is actually mass, and we have this Landau-Ginzburg function and stuff like that. But all we are describing is precisely the picture on the left-hand side, right? We are just describing n vector model where you have some spins in the lattice, and these spins interact together, right? So now, of course, if there is xi goes to infinity, these spins would have to order, right? But as I start increasing the temperature, of course there will be some fluctuations of these spins, and so for sufficiently high temperature, I have to destroy the order, right? So this cannot be true for any temperature, and so we must have that. There is, you know, sufficiently high enough temperature where xi has to be finite. Okay, so we must have Tc such that the correlation length. So this is what we found is 1 over x to eta t. Has to have an exponential decay to gx proportional to e to minus x over xi, where xi is finite, and then x to eta t. Or, in other words, we must have a finite correlation length for sufficiently high temperature. Okay, so xi can be infinite for t smaller than tc, but has to be finite for t bigger than tc. Okay. So this must be physically true, because we are just describing spins sitting in the lattice. And so really, if you have high enough temperature, you know, you have to destroy the correlations between the spins. And so that's why there must be a finite correlation length above this critical temperature. All right. But we are still finding that gx goes to infinity is sort of 0. Okay, so this critical temperature cannot have anything to do with a long branch order. Okay, so now what's actually going on wrong here is the fact that we pretended that it's not compactified is the presence of vortices. So if theta is compactified, and so you have an angle here, actually, you can order all the spins so that they actually create so-called vortex. Okay, So, so by assuming, theta non-compact, we neglected a possibility of having vortices, having a vortex. So now what is a vortex? Okay, so vortex has a vortex core, which is this point here. Okay, and then from that vortex, you would have all the spins, let's say, running out. So you would have a spin going like that, It's like putting a charge somewhere, and then the electric field would be just pointing all the way around. Okay, so this is my vector n, pointing this direction, pointing that direction, pointing that direction. So this is the vortex core. It stands here. So now vortex is something which is called a topological defect. And topological defects have the property that they can be actually, you can tell from very, very far away that the vortex is present. Okay, so how will you notice the presence of the vortex is through the Stokes theorem or Gauss theorem or whatever. So you know that if you have a charge somewhere in some volume, you can actually tell from very, very far away by calculating the flux around, you put a ball around this and you calculate the flux through this ball. And if there is a non-trivial flux, you know, yeah, there must be a charge inside. So this is precisely what we do for the vortex, but now in less dimensions. So we use the Stokes theorem instead of the Gauss theorem. So if you want the presence of a vortex, if I introduce an angle theta here, which goes around this thing here, as we did above, is the same theta, then the presence of the vortex is that if I draw a circle C around this vortex, and I can draw it with any radius or whatever, I can go all the way to infinity, and I calculate the circulation around this circle, and if I get non-zero, then I know there is a vortex inside. Okay, so mathematically, this is just written as a line integral over this circle C, nabla theta times dl is equal to something non-trivial. Okay, let's denote it by m so that we don't have all n's. Okay, so you calculate this integral, you draw a circle around this, and you calculate the line integral of this nabla theta, just like calculating the flux. And then if you get something non-trivial here on the right-hand side, then you say that there is a vortex there. And this number m actually characterizes, it's called winding number, and characterizes how strong the vortex is. If m is equal to 1, you have like one strength of the vortex is 1. If m is 2, you have 2, and so on. So this is called a winding number. Winding number. So m equals to 1, 2, 3. But interestingly, it can also go to negative values, as you all see. So it can go also minus 1, minus 2, minus 3, and so on. Yeah?
Each vortex, so you have your Mexican hat, and each vortex is in a point in the bottom of the hat, right?
It's
in a point.
It is the point.
In each point, you only have one arrow, right? So this is kind of a statistical superposition.
No. So what I'm talking about here is really how the spins are ordered in the crystal. So really what I'm saying is that I have taken the continuous limit of the crystal So, but what it means is that I have an underlying lattice somewhere here, and that really all the spins are pointing away from one point in that crystal. So that's yeah. So here I'm really talking about the spins, how the spins are pointing in the crystal. Which is probably the same thing what you just said, yeah. Other questions?
Does the Lyapunov number have to be an integer?
Yes.
But I mean, the arrow in the core.
Sorry?
The arrow in the core.
There or in the core?
In the core of the vortex,
yep.
There's an arrow, right? There's a spin.
In the core, which is of course a point or whatever, then you cannot say, yeah. Yeah, this is not well defined, but yeah. Okay, so because you like the lattice so much. Well, this would be true in the continuous limit, but if you have the lattice, actually you have to take into account that the core is somewhere, you know, in between the lattice things. So in lattice, actually you would have a picture like let's say the vortex is sitting here. So then I'm saying, you know, at this point, the guy is pointing this direction, that guy is pointing that direction, that guy is pointing that direction, right? So now this guy is pointing that direction, that guy is pointing that direction, that guy is pointing that direction, and so on. Okay, so this is what would be happening in the real lattice, is that actually, so but you see is that basically what the presence of a vortex means that I have to twist around all the spins in the lattice, and so this reaches very very far away. So it doesn't matter where I draw the circle, whether I draw it basically at infinity or if I draw it close enough, I still get the same 2 pi m, right? So actually all the spins in the whole lattice have to be, you know, twisted by the presence of the vortex somewhere in the middle. Okay, so that's why this is energetically very, very costly to create a vortex, because you have to twist all the spins in the lattice, and that costs lots of energy. In fact, infinite energy. Okay, so the presence of vortices, and this question, can you have these vortices if they cost infinite energy? And so naively you would say no, because, you know, I have to twist all the spins and it takes lots of energy. But actually energy is not what is important for thermodynamic considerations. It's the free energy which is important, as we learned by studying thermodynamic phase transitions. And so actually the free energy, which is energy minus T times S, if this becomes negative, we can have vortices, as we will see in a minute. Okay, so this is the picture. So now, notice also one thing here is that in continuous limit, we have that picture over here, and so it seems right, like, you know, all the spins starting from a point, and so what you can show is that by solving that equation is that the Nabla theta goes like 1 over r. Well, it's very simple. By looking at this equation, you know that dl in the end has to give you something like 2 pi r. And so Nabla theta, in order to cancel the r, which doesn't appear on the right-hand side, you have that Nabla theta has to go like 1 over r. Okay. And so you see that as r goes to zero, Nabla theta goes to infinity. Okay. So actually, if you use this picture here, then close to the origin, this is problematic. Close to origin, this. So origin, I mean, r goes to zero. This is problematic. And so we will, when we will calculate the energy of these things, we will never go all the way to the origin, but you will only go to the origin up to the letter spacing A. And it's obvious, so when integrating the energy, we introduce cutoff. Which will be the lattice spacing A. Okay, so we will not go all the way to the center of the vortex, but we'll only go at the distance A. But if you look at this thing here, really, so this is the lattice, the correct description of the things. But you see that this is as close as you can get, which is approximately the distance A. But at this distance A, actually, the nabla of theta here is just pi half. So this theta is actually pi half. Actually, the spins, the biggest gradient you can have for the spins, if you are in the lattice, is actually something like pi half over A or something like that. So the continuous limit actually breaks down in the core, but the lattice actually ensures that everything is well defined. Okay, so you cannot have infinite gradient. Actually, the biggest gradient you have, it's in the nearest neighborhood of the core, and it's just pi half. Okay, so we can have vortices maybe if the thermodynamics permits them. So let us calculate, you know, how much energy it costs to create a vortex and what is the corresponding free energy. And so can we have a temperature where the vortices actually start existing on their own? Okay, so that's the plan. So let's estimate the energy of the vortex. And of course, we have to be ready that it will be something like infinity because we have to twist all the spins. Okay, so how we do that? So we know this is our action. Action is basically the Hamiltonian, right? So the only difference is pq dot, but there is nothing time dependent here. So action is actually the Hamiltonian. So Hamiltonian here is 1 over 2 b square x nabla theta square. And so now we want to vary this Hamiltonian. D square x. And then you have nabla delta theta times nabla theta. You integrate by parts. Minus 1/2 d square x. And then you have nabla square theta, delta theta. Okay. This must be equal to 0. We are minimizing the action or minimizing the energy if you want. And so you are getting that the vortex is simply described by an equation that nabla square theta equals to 0. But I have been cheating here because I treated just the action as this thing here. But you still have the constraint that the vortex is present. Okay, so we still need to know that equation which defines the vortex. So we still have the equation that over the circle, nabla theta times delta L equals to 2 pi m. So this is the constraint which still has to be satisfied. So now vortices are just described by these two equations, nabla square theta equals to 0, and the constraint that we have a non-trivial vortex. Okay, so this is the two equations which we have to satisfy. Okay. And so now can anybody give me a solution for these two equations? So remember, the theta is the angle how do the spins actually twist around the core. So let's say I introduce coordinates, polar coordinates r and phi. And if you introduce the polar coordinates r and phi, then if you are looking at the first equation, you are solving nabla squared theta, which is function of phi and r, is equals to 0. So if you write it, this nabla square in the polar coordinates, there will certainly be term of something like 1 over d phi square, d over d phi square. Okay, so if I take a term which is linear in phi, then you it will kill the term and you'll solve this equation nabla square on theta equals to 0. So in polar coordinates, it's r and phi, you have the theta, actually m times phi, will solve this thing here. And it will actually solve both things. So definitely solve the Laplace equation, nabla square on theta equals to 0. And then if it's linear in phi, and then from the second equation, I can actually get that this proportionality constant is actually m. So indeed, if you calculate nabla of theta in the polar coordinates, you just get m phi over r. If you integrate over the circle, you get 2 pi m. So now energy. It's just given by the Hamiltonian for our solution, theta. So energy E is just 1/2. And then this thing here, d square x, nabla theta square. So that's what we have for energy. So this is, if you do it in polar coordinates, so this will be 0 to 2 pi d phi. And then you integrate over the r in the polar coordinates. And then this thing is just m square, y square is just 1 divided by r square. M square, r square, and then r coming from the polar coordinates. Okay, so now r goes all the way to the size of the system L. And I told you that we cannot integrate for small r because actually nabla theta is not well defined there. But we can only go as close to the core as the lattice spacing A. All right, so this is beautiful. So we get 2 pi out of this guy, divided by 1/2, so it's pi. And then we have m squared over r. And if you integrate m squared over r over the r, you get a logarithm. So pi, m squared, and then logarithm of r. And we evaluate it at L and A. And so this is what it is. OK. So this is how much energy it costs to create a vortex. And you see, because of the presence of this L, it diverges both in as L goes to infinity and as A goes to 0. But you see that, you know, it really it behaves like logarithm of L. And as the sine of the size of the system goes to infinity, as L goes to infinity, of course, this guy is divergent. So bigger the system you have, more energy it costs to create a vortex, which is of course true, because I have to order more spins. I have to order more spins. So this is very costly. Costs lots of energy. To create a vortex. Okay. However, it will still be thermodynamically possible. So So we need to term all spins in lattice. And that's why turning one spin costs some energy, but turning all of them costs lots of energy. And that's why this is OK. So now at finite t, however, finite t, the thing which really decides whether there can be any vortices is the free energy. Okay. To find if vortices is possible, are possible. Consider the free energy. F is the energy minus temperature times the entropy. So we already calculated what energy is. So now let's calculate the entropy, and let's do it in very crude way. So the entropy is given by a logarithm of number of states, okay? And so in our case, it's basically, you know, when you create a vortex somewhere in the system, somewhere in the lattice, you may be asking in how many possibilities you can create this one vortex. And so basically that's asking, you know, in how many places you can place this vortex in the lattice, okay? And so I'm in two dimensions, and so I have length of the system is L in this way, and so the how many cells I have in this direction is L over A, okay? But now I'm in two dimensions, so I have another one, L over A, so it's L square over A square possibilities I have, okay? So this is log of the number of places. Places we can place the vortex, place a vortex. Okay, so this is, and that's equal to logarithm of L over A square, because that's the number of cells I have where I can place my vortex here. And so it's 2 times logarithm L over A. Okay, so the entropy is also huge. It actually goes like logarithm L over A as well. Okay, and so for this reason, if you are interested in the free energy, so F, well, it's E minus TS. We calculated that E is pi m squared logarithm L over A. But let's say we are creating one vortex, so m is equal to 1. So the simplest possible vortex, m is equal to 1, the simplest possible, the smallest possible energy is when it's m is equal to 1. So then we have pi minus 2t times logarithm L over A. Okay, so that's the free energy. Okay, and so now you say, well, I can arrange always that if in the non-vortex configuration, my free energy will be equal to 0. So then you have sort of like one phase where there is no vortices. And then you have the phase with vortices, which has this free energy here. So then if you are plotting the free energy with respect to the temperature, right? So if I arrange that one phase when there is no vortices, looks like this thing here. OK, so there'll be no vortices. That's one phase. And then I have another phase, which is pi minus 2t. So that behaves like a constant minus 2t. So it will have something like this, maybe. OK, so let's say one vortex phase. So now you know that you want to minimize your free energy. And so that's why actually here, this is the minimum. But then this is the minimum here. OK. So actually, there exists this critical temperature here. And so below here, I have no vortex phase, no vortex phase. And above that critical temperature, I have one vortex phase. OK. So then by a phase transition here, of course, the critical temperature where this happens is precisely when the free energy of that guy becomes zero. So if you set the free energy equal to zero, you are getting that T is pi half. And so in other words, T bigger than this T critical, which actually, well, OK, so T critical, but let's put the famous guys here. KT stands for Kosterlitz and Paulus. And so T bigger than TKT, which is pi half, then we can have vortices. And have vortices. So this is a Kosterlitz and Paulus temperature. And so why I'm talking about this is that you are now completely up to date. Well, you have seen in a relativity course that there was awarded a Nobel Prize for gravitational waves in 2017. And so now you are learning about the Nobel Prize 1 year earlier. So these guys were awarded a Nobel Prize in 2016. And so it was Kosterlitz, Taules, and a gentleman who is connected and associated with PI. So also Duncan Haldane. So Kosterlitz, Taules, and Haldane actually got a Nobel Prize of 2016 for this. And so what they really discovered here is that, yeah, we are in two dimensions. We cannot have long range order. So it seems that there cannot be any phase transitions. However, there are these phase transitions. And the phase transition is that below this TKT, actually, I don't have any vortices in my spin chain. But above this thing, suddenly the vortices start forming, and I can have free vortices coming, you know, in the world. And so because the vortices are topological defects, so what we just described here is not a standard phase transition, but a topological phase transition. And the fact that really, you know, you can have different kinds of phase transitions was, you know, good enough to get a Nobel Prize. Of course, if it were just a theory, nobody would give you a Nobel Prize. But actually, this has been observed. So this has been observed in something like helium-4 or whatever. And so this is backed up with the experiment. And that's why you can actually get a Nobel Prize if it's really confirmed experimentally.
So this happens exactly at n equals 2?
Yeah.
Are there other situations where?
I don't know. Maybe it can happen in other situations, but definitely in d equal to 2 and n equal to 2. Yeah.
What about the other vortices?
What about the other vortices?
Anti-vortex pairs.
Okay. I'll talk about it. So we discussed basically in our course, we discussed the first order phase transition. This is the most typical one. And it's something like a liquid gas phase transition, and there is a latent heat here. And so these are the most typical at least in then we discuss the second order phase transitions or continuous phase transitions, which was, for example, the Ising model. However, then you can have many more very interesting other phase transitions. For example, you can have topological phase transitions, or you can have something like glassy phase transitions. So, whereas first order, if you want, the characteristic of that is that the order parameter sort of jumps, you have to provide latent heat, and because you have to provide latent heat, actually two phases can coexist together, because you know liquid is not changing to gas unless you heat it up, right? So you can have two phases coexisting together. Second order is the order parameter is actually continuous, but yeah, you can have a long range order, so that's a typical characteristic for second order phase transitions. However, you can have something like these topological phase transitions when there is no order. But nevertheless, you can have some kind of phase transition. And so then who the hell knows what is? People probably know, I don't know. So there are other types of phase transitions as well in the nature. Okay. So very good. So now somebody said, what happens with vortex anti-vortex pair? And it was you. So you will be punished for that. Okay, so now what is vortex and what is anti-vortex? So basically, vortex and anti-vortex are sort of like charge and minus charge or anti-charge, and so they are characterized by so charge is characterized by positive m, vortex is characterized by positive m, and anti-vortex is characterized by negative m. And so let me just make a very very short remark can have antivortices so those for which m is negative. So typically, the vortex looks like what I have plot here. So this would be the situation when m equals to plus 1. So now, if m equals to minus 1, it actually goes like this, goes like that, goes like that, goes like this. This is m equals to minus 1. OK, so you have vortex here. And you have anti-vortex here. Anti-vortex here. So now what you can do is that you can sort of pop out of the vacuum, out of the lattice, you can pop both of them simultaneously. It's like if you have vacuum fluctuations, and so you have the vacuum, and suddenly you create a charge and a minus charge. You can do that, right? And that actually doesn't cost that much energy. So you can actually always create a charge, create a minus charge. And now if I surround this by my ball, I still measure that there is no flux through this ball. So actually, the total charge is still equal to zero. So that's fine, because it means that actually I don't know very, very far away from this charge-anti-charge pair. I don't know about the fact that I created anything. So it doesn't cost that much energy as actually having one charge there. Because, so in other words, if I have vortex and anti-vortex, I don't have to order all the spins everywhere in the crystal. I can only do it in the vicinity of the vortex and anti-vortex. So to create vortex anti-vortex pair costs a lot less energy than actually to create just a vortex or just anti-vortex than whatever I calculated here, than E above. And so even below the temperature, so even below TKT, you can have vortices present in your spin chain, can have vortices but these are bound to form, you know, these are bound to be in the form of pairs, and these pairs sort of cannot split. So they can sort of you can create the pair vortex anti-vortex pair, and it disappears after some time again. Okay, so can have vortices in pairs, but not isolated ones. Okay. And so really, you can pop up the pair of vortex anti-vortex even below this critical temperature, but you cannot isolate the vortex and to be on its own. And that can only happen if you are above TKT. Above TKT, you have enough energy, you have enough fluctuations, so that actually you can pop up one vortex, which is now isolated and living on its own in the lattice. And so this is actually quite interesting. So we had this, I think it's still here. This thing here. So we said, well, physically, this must be true, that we must have xi equals to infinity for t smaller than t critical, but xi finite for t bigger than t critical. So now some people are trying to give this an interpretation, is that if you think about xi, which is the correlation length, is something like a distance between the two vortices. Okay, so then if you are above the TKT, so if you are above the TKT, you can have free vortices, and the distance of these is actually finite. If you are below TKT, you cannot have free vortices. So actually, xi, which is the distance between the two free vortices, is infinite.
Can you have propagating forces?
Can you have propagating
forces?
Vortices. Vortices. Like they would be moving through the. I think so.
Do you know the dispersion relation?
Special relation?
Dispersion relation.
Dispersion relation. I don't know. I don't know, but I'm sure it's been calculated. Okay, so let's give it a try. So maybe can we have the screen? Thank you. And so let's see if this will work.
I have a quick question.
Yeah.
So does like the position of the vortices emerge as like a new degree of freedom in like the action or something that you have to?
Well, if your action is this thing here. But yeah.
If you write down like an effective action between the one vortex phase, or like in the M vortex phase.
Okay.
You have to write down like kinetic terms for the positions.
I see. I don't know.
Sorry.
I don't know. Okay, so let's see if this will work. Yeah. Just a second. Miracle. So I just want to show you this thing here. So there's again this web page which I discovered somewhere. And it basically discusses these vortices and anti-vortices. So sorry. Oh no. So this is how the vortex looks like. So basically, you can have the spins which sort of rotate around that vortex core, but they have to be rotating, you know, in one direction so that you get this two pi m is equal to one. So this is how the vortex would look like. So now, if you have an anti-vortex, this is how it looks like. So now you see that, you know, these are pointing, the opposite things are pointing in, but these guys are pointing out. So now remember that everything is has O(n) symmetry. So I can start rotating all the spins, and if I rotate all the spins with the same angle, then actually it's still the same configuration, so still the same symmetry. So now actually you can look at these guys. So these definitely still describe the same vortex or anti-vortex thing here. So see how you know all I'm rotating all the spins at the same thing. And so the first one is still the vortex, still m equal to 1. But the second one is still the anti-vortex, m equals to minus 1. OK, so this is how it looks like in the crystal. And so finally, I would like to show you this beautiful thing here. Where is it? It was here. I saw it. This one here. So this is the most beautiful thing here. It's gone again. Sorry for that. Anyway, so it's just small, but OK. So here, you can actually see how this vortex anti-vortex pair can be created in this crystal, right? So I'm creating a vortex, I'm creating an anti-vortex here dynamically, and so they can, you know, and so you see that as you start separating them, it's actually further and further away spins start feeling their presence, right? But if you create them just immediately as you create them, those spins which are very far away, they don't know about them because there's no total flux through that, right? But only once you start separating them, actually, the further away and the further away spins actually know about them, and that's why it costs more and more energy as you start separating this vortex and anti-vortex pair. Okay, and so it costs an infinite energy if you actually have a single one free to roam through your crystal and these other ones single free here. So anyway, so you can read this. I'll upload this link to the wiki, and you can play with this. But I think it's quite beautiful that you can have also other phase transitions which are not characterized by an order parameter, and there is no long range order here. Are there any questions? All right. So this finishes my part of the course. And as I said, on Friday, there will be like black hole thermodynamics bonus lecture. If you are interested, please come. If not, it's not compulsory. Thanks.